law, like Napoleonic law, is deductive. Lawmakers determine a principle, write it down, and impose it on the society. Common law is an emergent property bubbling up from the society itself. Common law evolved case by case, which is why some call it judge-made law. Common law, writes Hannon, is thus empirical rather than conceptual. It concerns itself with actual judgments that have been handed down in real cases, and then asks whether they need to be modified in the light of different circumstances in a new case. And English common law recognized the rights of all Englishmen, which made all the difference. I don't want to get bogged down in the history of the Magna Carta. The Brits don't say the as we do, by the way. They simply say Magna Carta. But it's worth noting that the Magna Carta came after the development of formal institutions of common law. In the late 12th century, Henry II created a system of circuit courts and even a central court of appeals. When the Magna Carta was struck a half century later, it recognized this development, creating a written precedent for the future. Likewise, the Magna Carta's requirement that the king rule in consultation in, quote, common council of the realm was a nod to more ancient traditions, while at the same time a new, incalculably valuable precedent for the creation of a formal parliamentary system. There are numerous other cultural idiosyncrasies that define English weirdness, or if you prefer, exceptionalism. The right to petition authorities for redress, the rights of the individual, an almost obsessive concern with just taxation, and numerous other concepts we tend to think of in high-flown philosophical or legal terms have deep roots in English custom. They emerged not as formal deductive law, but through local trial and error over countless generations. In subsequent chapters, I will refer often to the Lockean Revolution to describe the gift we inherited from the founding era of both England's Glorious Revolution and the American Revolution. But as I will explain, the problem with the term Lockean Revolution is that it makes it sound like the extended order of liberty was purely a kind of legalistic creation crafted by lawyers and philosophers like Locke. The truth is, it developed and evolved organically over a millennium before Locke did us all the great service of writing some of it down. Just as the Magna Carta locked in certain principles in 1215, Locke and the American founders did something very similar. The colonists at the time of the American founding saw themselves, for the most part, as English. They brought their weird cultural biases with them, and their argument with the crown was an extension of the Whiggish fight for liberty that defined English history for 1,000 years. As Winston Churchill observed in his History of the English-Speaking Peoples, the Declaration of Independence was in the main a restatement of the principles which had animated the Whig struggle against the later Stuarts and the English Revolution of 1688. Just as Martin Luther King Jr. used America's best ideals to make the case for a richer liberty in America, the founders invoked England's highest principles to make the case for their liberties in the New World. Jefferson's rough draft of the Declaration included the line, "We might have been a free and great people together," but it was cut from the final version. Still, the Declaration drips with a sense of familial betrayal. "We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence." That line about the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here is a reference to the fact that so many of the original colonists crossed the ocean in search of religious liberties that had been denied to them at home. Indeed, as important as the issue of unjust taxation was to the founders, the cause of religious liberty served as a vital motivation as well. The Church of England had, in the years leading up to the Revolution, tried to impose an official faith in the colonies and even install American bishops, arousing a wellspring of vestigial Puritan rage. The American Revolution was, at least in part, the result of a spasm of religious intolerance, writes Hannan. That this spasm should have engendered the first truly secular state on earth, one in which all religions might compete on even terms, is close to miraculous. The reason I bring this up is that I think we often fail to see the Constitution in the proper light. The profound, though at times insufficient, legal authority we invest in it tends to obscure the cultural authority of the document. And so we talk about it in formalistic terms. Section 1 says this, Section 2 says that, and so on. The Whiggish legal historians naturally see history as a book in which each page is filled with new legal documents. But these documents almost always are lagging indicators, validations of cultural advances. And it is fine for historians, lawyers, and lawmakers to see the past through the legal prism of the present. It is, in fact, essential for lawyers and lawmakers to look at the text and the textual history of the Constitution. But the Constitution is not simply a machine on parchment or an instruction manual for the government. It is an expression of a specific culture at a specific time, and that culture comes from somewhere. Specifically, it comes from England. Patrick Henry, at the Virginia Ratifying Convention of 1788, spoke glowingly of their glorious forefathers of Great Britain, who made liberty the foundation of everything. Numerous Latin American countries have constitutions based on the American model, but they have struggled to recreate America's political and economic successes because culture matters a lot. Not for nothing did Alexis de Tocqueville describe the American as the Englishman left to himself. For a certain group of intellectuals on the right, and to a lesser extent on the left, the Constitution is the wellspring of the American order. From one perspective, this is undoubtedly true. The Constitution provides guardrails for our society in all the formal and legal ways you can think of, even if those guardrails have, over time, succumbed to entropy thanks to a lack of care in their upkeep. But the Constitution is a cultural and psychological artifact as well. It informs the way we think about government, rights, and civil society. Our tendency to take things for granted rusts all that glitters eventually. So when we say, I can do this because the Constitution gives me the right to do this, it seems perfectly natural. But it is actually one of the most radical things a human can say. Like the Magna Carta that came before it, one of the greatest services the Constitution provides is that it is simply written down. As Ernest Gellner has noted, humans have a tendency to sacralize texts. That is precisely what Americans have done with the Constitution. Thank goodness. Barack Obama said in his farewell address, Our Constitution is a remarkable, beautiful gift. But it's really just a piece of parchment. It has no power on its own. We, the people, give it power with our participation and the choices we make. Whether or not we stand up for our freedoms, whether or not we respect and enforce the rule of law, America is no fragile thing. But the gains of our long journey to freedom are not assured. Many of my fellow conservatives were angered by this, and given Barack Obama's remarkable yoga master-like flexibility in interpreting constitutional text, I can understand why. But on its face, Obama's claim was right. The Constitution only has real power if the people give it power. James Madison noted as much when he fretted that parchment barriers are often inadequate against the encroaching spirit of power. The real power of the Constitution is to be found not in it, but in us. The Constitution is a paper manifestation of a deeper cultural commitment to liberty and limited government. In the same way, a marriage certificate is a physical and legalistic representation of something far deeper, mysterious, and complicated. When the marriage fails, the marriage certificate won't save it. And when the American people lose their love of liberty, the Constitution will not save us either. What made the American founding such an amazing, one-of-a-kind event was that it took the weirdness of one obscure, successful tribe, culled from its cultural peculiarities, universal principles, and then wrote them down. The founders had enormous help from John Locke, who did much of the intellectual groundwork in support of the Glorious Revolution 100 years earlier. And they also had help from Montesquieu and the philosophes and many others, including Cicero. The text needed to be amended over time to make those principles more universal. But the basic cultural inheritance was amplified by the intellectuals and statesmen, and their work in turn reinforced the culture. Having made the case, however briefly or tediously, that America's love of liberty is in fact a cultural artifact bequeathed to us from England, let me now claw it back, at least somewhat. The problem with this tale, and many like it, is that it is what Rudyard Kipling would call a just-so story. A just-so story in anthropology is a form of post-hoc fallacy that says, because B follows A and C follows B, therefore A caused B and B caused C. Though he tries to deny it, Hannon is offering an updated and often compelling version of the Whig interpretation of history, as famously formulated by the historian Herbert Butterfield in his conveniently titled 1931 book, The Whig Interpretation of History. Butterfield criticized previous generations of British historians who described world history as if it were an unfolding novel whose plot and conclusion were knowable to all. The heroes of the tale were lovers of liberty, the villains the forces of absolutism and arbitrary power. Their story was the tale of the inevitable victory of British liberal values. As Butterfield put it, there is a lamentable tendency in many historians to write on the side of Protestants and Whigs, to praise revolutions provided they have been successful, to emphasize certain principles of progress in the past, and to produce a story which is the ratification, if not the glorification, of the present. He adds, the Whig historian can draw lines through certain events, and if he is not careful, he begins to forget that this line is merely a mental trick of his. He comes to imagine that it represents something like a line of causation. The total result of this method is to impose a certain form upon the whole historical story and to produce a scheme of general history which is bound to converge beautifully upon the present, all demonstrating throughout the ages the workings of an obvious principle of progress. Teleology, the great sin of historians, is the idea that there is a purpose to things and events, a grand plan that we are all working under. Providence is, of course, the most famous teleological claim. It's all God's plan. Prior to the Enlightenment, this was pretty much every Westerner's theory of everything. The great Enlightenment thinkers threw out religion as the driver of history, but they thought they spied a different prime mover, progress, and later history, with a capital H. Mankind was ineluctably getting freer and better. Different philosophers debated how this progress worked and why it was inevitable. Ultimately, teleology is an antidote to despair and nihilism. Just as we as individual humans want to believe there's a point to our own personal lives, we also want to believe there's a point to everyone else's. Indeed, unless you fancy yourself a messiah or prophet of some kind, you pretty much have to believe that there's an external, metaphysical purpose to life for everyone if you believe in such a thing for yourself. The reason I raise the issue of teleology is to illuminate the fact that if there is a purpose to economic and political evolution, we can no more prove its existence than we can prove God's. It requires a leap of faith. Maybe this is all God's plan, or maybe the universe has a purpose. Or maybe history, like life, is just one damn thing after another. At countless moments in English history, things could have gone very differently. The fact that the good forces won does not mean they were destined to. The gunpowder plot, in which a group of English Catholics tried to assassinate King James I by blowing up the House of Lords during a royal address, failed, thus saving England from a very different fate. But it didn't fail because of the English love of liberty. It failed because one person, with knowledge of the scheme to reduce Parliament to rubble and return Catholicism to England, sent a letter exposing the plot. Whether Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church so he could bed Anne Boleyn, or because he wanted a wife to produce a male heir, the fact is that if Catherine of Aragon, his first wife, had been able to provide Henry with a son, or perhaps even if Anne Boleyn had had lower standards and agreed to be his mistress, England might have stayed a Catholic nation. It is fine and dandy to pan the river of Germanic history to sift out the Republican and Democratic nuggets as proof England was destined to usher in the era of liberty. But I don't think it's a gross overstatement to suggest that one can find counterexamples in the historical record. None of this is to say that Hannon, a friend of mine, is wrong. It is to say that he was right when he said the English stumbled into modernity. The tradition of English liberty was a flame that could have been extinguished if the winds of history had shifted slightly at any one of a thousand different moments. We are fortunate that circumstances worked out the way they did. But at the most fundamental level, if you take providence or some other teleological theory of the purpose of history out of the equation, modernity happened in England by accident. The ingredients for liberty and prosperity have existed on Earth for thousands of years, sloshing around, occasionally bumping into each other, and offering a glimpse to a better path. Religious toleration, restraints on monarchy, private property, the sovereignty of the individual, pluralistic institutions, scientific innovation, the rule of law. All of these things can be found piecemeal across the ages. The Chinese were path-breaking scientific and bureaucratic innovators, but they couldn't relinquish their political monopoly and eventually snuffed out technological progress in the name of imperial hegemony. Private property, likewise, existed in one form or another in countless societies, but it alone was not enough, absent the other necessary ingredients, and without those ingredients, private property was often snuffed out. Prosperity itself wasn't unknown before the miracle, but it was always a short-lived and local phenomenon. To understand how miraculous the miracle really is, we should take a moment and look more closely at some of the more well-known competing theories about why the Great Enrichment happened, including the complicated role of Protestantism, real and imagined, as well as the scientific revolution, slavery, imperialism, and other materialist factors. The Protestant origin story of the miracle takes several forms on its own and informs other theories as well. The first and most straightforward theory, famously introduced by the sociologist Max Weber in his Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, published in Germany in 1905 and in English in 1930, holds that Protestantism, particularly certain Puritan sects like the Calvinists, created new habits of the heart that gave birth to capitalism. The simple version of this story goes like this. The otherworldly Catholic cared little about material things in this life and was content to live in a materially impoverished life, working as little as he or she needed to. Meanwhile, Weber argued, Protestants believed in accumulating wealth. The Puritan, powered by the doctrine of predestination, moved his sights to this world, believing that material success was proof of virtue and a sign that one had been selected for reward in the next life. Hard work was a way to give glory to God. But economic success was achieved not just through hard work, but by demonstrating honest dealings, piety, of course, and thriftiness. The summum bonum of this ethic is the earning of more and more money. Acquisition is the ultimate purpose of life, explained Weber in a passage casting Benjamin Franklin as the poster boy for Protestant industriousness. As Joyce Appleby summarizes Weber's argument, Protestant preachers produced great personal anxiety by emphasizing everyone's tenuous grip on salvation. In turn, this promoted an interest in providence in which believers scrutinized economic events for clues to divine intentions, which turned prosperity into evidence of God's favor. In other words, acting as if you're blessed might actually be a sign you're blessed. The theological version of fake it until you make it. Let's put a pin in this theory and what it actually means for a moment. While Weber published this theory in the first decade of the 20th century, the idea that capitalism depends on thrift, or the accumulation of capital through savings, was central to the bulk of Marxist thought in the 19th century. Marx believed that capitalism was, at its core, simply the exploitation of labor. All wealth and value, according to Marx, is created by the workers. All profit that does not go to the workers is essentially theft. Since all value is captured by labor, any surplus value collected by the owners of capital is by definition exploitative. The businessman or inventor who risks his own money to build and staff a factory is not adding value. He is subtracting value from the workers. Indeed, the money he used to buy the land and the materials is really just dead labor. Marx is still seen by many as a forward-thinking visionary. But the truth is, Marx was a romantic popularizer of ancient biases against money and finance, or usury, and, to a very large extent, Jews. To a degree rarely appreciated, Marx merely recast the traditional Christian stigmatization of money-making into a new vocabulary and reiterated the ancient suspicion against those who used money to make money, writes historian Jerry Z. Muller. In his concept of capitalism as exploitation, Marx returns the very old idea that money is fundamentally unproductive, that only those who live by the sweat of their brow truly produce, and that therefore not only interest, but profit itself is always ill-gotten. This idea that excess capital or surplus value fueled capitalism is essential for numerous Marxist and Marx-ish explanations for its triumph. They all rest on a psychological desire among the enemies of capitalism, starting with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, to claim that capitalism was born in some kind of original sin. Some writers want slavery to be capitalism's original sin in order to exaggerate the crime of slavery and to justify calls for reparations and or to delegitimize capitalism. But slavery requires no such exaggeration. Its evil stands on its own right. Similarly, claims that the West got rich by pillaging foreign lands amount to an effort to pad the indictment against imperialism. These theories all share the psychological assumption that capitalism marked a wrong turn in humanity's past, and they often drive people to make patently ridiculous claims. Without slavery, you have no cotton. Without cotton, you cannot have modern industry, Marx wrote. It is slavery which has given their value to the colonies. It is the colonies which have created the commerce of the world. It is the commerce of the world which is the essential condition of the great industry. Never mind that Japanese dependence on silk from China was at least as great as England's demand for cotton, yet Japan did not become a capitalist country until after World War II. The idea that cheap cotton, made possible by slavery, jump-started capitalism, most recently revived by Harvard's Sven Beckert, overlooks the fact that the price of cotton didn't increase appreciably after slavery in the United States was abolished. In fact, in the 1870s, it was 42% lower than the pre-Civil War price. Deirdre McCloskey surveys the research and finds the evidence to support such claims somewhere between non-existent and meager. Yes, of course, enormous profits were made from both slavery and empire, but neither created capitalism, and the profits were ultimately incidental in the grand scheme of things. Moreover, if capitalism is dependent on the sort of mass-scale exploitation implicit in slavery and imperialism, why did capitalism take so long to materialize? The ancient Chinese, Persians, Romans, and Aztecs all had empires and slaves, yet none were capitalist. Why has capitalism survived the demise of slavery and the age of empire? Why are traditional and anti-capitalist societies more likely to maintain the institution of slavery in one form or another? If capitalism relies on exploitation, why have Westerners gotten so much richer and enjoy such an abundance of leisure time? The claim that thrift, i.e. increased savings from profit creating the capital necessary for industrial investment, led to the rise of capitalism falls apart once you realize that it gets the causality backward. Capital accumulation is not the engine of capitalism. It is the byproduct of it. Indeed, thrift is hardly a Western or Christian invention, never mind a Protestant one. People have saved or otherwise been careful with their money since money was invented. But absent a market system, what someone could do with their money is extremely limited. Other materialist theories about the origins of capitalism, some quite interesting and important, ultimately fail to satisfy the question, where does the miracle come from? The relative autonomy of European city-states and principalities surely encouraged freedom and served as tributaries that led to eventual dam breaking. Sure, British and European geography was no doubt essential to Europe's political development. But the idea that capitalism was inevitable because of Europe's rivers and temperate climate is the ultimate just-so story. The scientific revolution, a miracle in its own right, is obviously a hugely important part of the story. Would the miracle have happened without Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, Thomas Edison, and other great scientists and innovators? I'm inclined to say probably not, but that does not mean the scientific revolution created capitalism. The deeper you look at this argument, the more you can see the cart overtaking the horse. The Islamic world in China had their turns at being at the forefront of science for centuries, and yet the miracle never materialized in either place. Indeed, for a millennium, England certainly, and arguably the entirety of Western Europe, were backwaters. An alien visiting Earth 1,000 years ago would not assume that the peoples of Europe were destined to achieve escape velocity from the norm of human existence. So what did create it? In order to answer that, we need to circle back to another theory of Protestantism's role in Western development. This theory holds that Protestantism unleashed the spirit of innovation and liberty. My National Review colleague Charles C.W. Cook, a Whig imported to our shores from England to do the hard work too few American-born writers will do, argues that Protestantism plays exactly this role. I have long argued in vague terms that America is a fundamentally Protestant society, he writes, by which I have absolutely not meant that only Protestants can be good citizens, but rather that the founders were the product of not just a religiously Protestant inheritance, but also of a politically Protestant worldview, and two, that the two are historically inextricable. This is to say, he continues, that once a people becomes accustomed to cutting out the middlemen from their path to God, absolution, and salvation, it becomes easier for them to countenance cutting out the middlemen from their path to liberty and the pursuit of happiness as well. To be sure, there's something to this. Protestantism wouldn't have spread without the printing press, an innovation that disrupted the Catholic Church's theological monopoly. Protestantism also breathed new life into the idea that the individual is sovereign. But this overlooks the fact that while Protestantism eliminated the middleman theologically, politically, Protestants were just as capable of crushing any deviation from orthodoxy as the most zealous Catholics. After all, early Protestants were not political moderates. They did more than their share of witch hunting. In England in the 1650s and 1660s, the Quakers were horribly brutalized by Anglicans. The Puritans of Salem weren't exactly a live-and-let-live bunch. In Europe, Lutherans and Calvinists adapted political, i.e. monarchical absolutism, to their theology quite easily, as did the Anglicans of Henry VIII's England. Frederick the Great was the most gifted absolute monarch of the 18th century, and he was raised in Calvinism. Now let me backpedal a bit. My point here is not to say that the various theories of where the miracle came from are entirely wrong. My objection is to any argument that singles out one factor and says this, and only this, is why it happened. Nearly all truly complex and important phenomena have multiple mutually dependent factors that lead to their creation. Why did World War II happen? Why are you the way you are? Any attempt to focus on a single, discrete, monocausal explanation is folly. And capitalism is far, far more complicated. The reason I call the emergence of the miracle a miracle is simply this. No one intended it. No single thing made it happen. It was an unplanned and glorious accident. Again, consider the crude version of the Weberian thesis. Even if you grant that Protestantism created capitalism, you must also acknowledge that this isn't what Protestants, starting with Luther, had in mind. Martin Luther despised usury in all its forms, no doubt in part because of his virulent anti-Semitism. No 17th century Puritan preacher said, "If you get rich, you'll get into heaven." They said, "Behave this way, and it's more likely that God will find you worthy." The changes in behavior elicited by this stern and pious instruction were never intended to be a get-rich-quick scheme. That would be so-called prosperity theology, a very recent creation closely associated with televangelism. Donald Trump's spiritual advisor, Paula White, is of this sect. Similarly, the pluralism that made capitalism possible wasn't a product of some high-minded ideal about how to structure society. The religious tolerance that starts to emerge in Europe after the Peace of Westphalia in 1648 was far less a product of theological changes than it was of political and military exhaustion. The Treaty of Westphalia ended the wars of religion in Europe. Those wars, running off and on for more than a century, took an enormous toll on Protestants and Catholics alike. In their wake, as historian C.V. Wedgwood put it, the West began to understand the essential futility of putting beliefs of the mind to the judgment of the sword. In other words, Protestants and Catholics alike settled on a modicum of tolerance as the last policy that remained when it had proved impossible to go on fighting any longer, in the words of Herbert Butterfield. The social space created was an advance in liberty, but that was nobody's first choice. Rather, it was an accidental byproduct of military futility. If I have to offer my own explanation for where the miracle comes from, I will second the argument put forth by Deirdre McCloskey in her awe-inspiring multi-volume work on the birth of capitalism. Her answer, in brief: the miracle is an attitude expressed in new ideas and the rhetoric that accompanies them. The North Sea economy, and then the Atlantic economy, and then the world economy grew because of changing forms of speech about markets and enterprise and innovation, she writes. These new forms of speech made innovation possible by recognizing innovation as a good thing. Innovation dies on the drawing board without a climate that welcomes and rewards it. The Chinese and Arab advantages in technology amounted to little in the long run because the political and religious climate proved inhospitable to sustain innovation, because innovation disrupts the status quo and undermines the powers that be. After all, the Chinese inventor Bichon invented printing centuries before Gutenberg. The Japanese had guns, but then banned them because they recognized the threat they posed to the aristocracy of the sword-wielding warrior class of the samurai. For centuries, Catholic and Protestant rulers alike were hostile to innovation for the same reason. For instance, in 1548, Edward VI, Henry VIII's successor, issued a proclamation against those that doth innovate. In her paper, "Meddle Not with Them That Are Given to Change, Innovation as Evil," Benoit Godin recounts the story of Henry Burton, a Puritan Church of England minister. Burton accused the church of innovating doctrine against the king's wishes in two pamphlets in 1636. He was called before the court to defend himself. The court found that Burton, not the church, was guilty of innovation. They sentenced Burton to prison for life after cutting off his ears. And this was Protestant England, the supposed ancestral homeland of liberty. But then something happened. About the end of the 17th century, Joseph Schumpeter writes in Business Cycles, A Theoretical, Historical, and Statistical Analysis of the Capitalist Process, the English political establishment dropped all systemic hostility to invention. So did public opinion and the scribes. It was this remarkable, unprecedented, miraculous change in attitude that made the miracle possible. The way people talked and thought about how the world worked changed. The economy is nothing without the word supporting it, McCloskey writes, whether conventional wisdom or creative entrepreneurial projects. I am almost wholly convinced by this. For 100,000 years, the great mass of humanity languished in poverty. This great flat line of material misery plodded along unchanged until attitudes changed in England and Holland, not just among intellectuals or aristocrats, but among the common people, particularly the bourgeois, the mostly urban middle and upper middle class of professionals, artisans, craftsmen, merchants, and other laborers who did not till the soil. Prior to that, notions of betterment, innovation, and improvement were seen literally as heresy. Curiositas, or curiosity, was a sin, and the innovator a heretic. For millennia, vested interests, bureaucrats, aristocrats, guilds, and priests alike, formed coalitions of common interest to stifle innovations. A few examples from Joel Mokyr, by way of McCloskey. In 1299, Florence banned bankers from adopting Arabic numerals. At the end of the 15th century, scribe guilds of Paris managed to fight off the adoption of the printing press for two decades. In 1397, pin manufacturers in Cologne outlawed the use of pin presses. In 1561, the City Council of Nuremberg made the manufacture and selling of lathes punishable with imprisonment. In 1579, the City Council of Danzig ordered the secret assassination by drowning of the inventor of a ribbon loom. In the late 1770s, the Strasbourg Council barred a local cotton mill from selling its wares in town because it would disrupt the business model of the cloth importers. This is an ancient and universal story of elites seeking to protect their privileges and incomes from the gales of change. It is why the Emperor of China burned his ocean-going vessels in 1525, and the Turkish Caliph banned the printing press in 1729. The merchant guilds that dominated much of Europe and the world for the better part of 1,000 years endured not because they met economic demand, but because they, with the help of the crown and the church, restricted it. They limited competition and reduced exchange by excluding craftsmen, peasants, women, Jews, foreigners, and the urban proletariat from most profitable branches of commerce, writes Sheila Ogilvy. Merchant guilds and associations were so widespread and so tenacious, not because they efficiently solved economic problems, making everyone better off, but because they efficiently distributed resources to a powerful urban elite with side benefits for rulers. Hostility to innovation and free trade was grounded in a broader worldview that saw money itself as the root of all evil. From the time of antiquity until the Enlightenment, trade and the pursuit of wealth were considered sinful. In the city that is most finely governed, Aristotle wrote, the citizens should not live a vulgar or a merchant's way of life, for this sort of way of life is ignoble and contrary to virtue. In his Republic, Plato laid out one vision of an ideal society in which the ruling guardians would own no property to avoid tearing the city in pieces by differing amounts of mine and not mine. He added that all the classes engaged in retail and wholesale trade are disparaged and subjected to contempt and insults. Furthermore, in his hypothetical utopian state, only non-citizens would be allowed to indulge in commerce. A citizen who defies the natural order and becomes a merchant should be thrown in jail for shaming his family. In ancient Rome, all trade was stigmatized as undignified. The word mercator, merchant, appears as almost a term of abuse, writes Professor D.C. Earle of the University of Leeds. Cicero noted in the 1st century B.C. that retail commerce is sordidis, vile, because merchants would not make any profit unless they lied constantly. Early Christianity expanded this point of view. Jesus himself was clearly hostile to the pursuit of riches. For where your treasure is, he proclaimed in his Sermon on the Mount, there will your heart be also. And of course, he insisted that it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. The official teaching of the Catholic Church echoed these sentiments for centuries, holding that economics was zero sum. The fathers of the church adhered to the classical assumption that since the material wealth of humanity was more or less fixed, the gain of some could only come at the loss to others, Jerry Z. Muller explains. As St. Augustine put it, si unus non perdit, alter non acquirit. If one does not lose, the other does not gain. The most evil form of wealth accumulation was the use of money to make money, i.e. usury. Lending money at interest was unnatural and therefore invidious. While expertise in exchange is justly blamed, since it is not according to nature, but involves taking from others, Aristotle insisted, usury is most reasonably hated because one's possessions derive from money itself and not from that for which it was supplied. So, of the sorts of business, this is the most contrary to nature. Aristotle was right that finance is contrary to the natural order. It is also the driver of incredible prosperity and human betterment. Despite all this, the case is often made that Christianity gets the credit for the miracle. And in broad strokes, I am open to the idea that without Christianity, the miracle may never have happened. But that is not quite the same argument as Christianity caused the miracle. And it certainly did not intend it. However, the lesser claim that Christianity was a necessary ingredient certainly seems likely. Jesus said that his followers should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, establishing that there were in fact two realms, which St. Augustine called the city of man and the city of God. The city of man was for temporal rulers, the city of God for ecclesiastical ones. When the Western Roman Empire fell, the church remained in Rome as a religious authority. This established the principle that the church would serve as the conscience for the realm. This really was a significant advance, creating one of the first and most important mental divisions of labor in the Western mind. Jesus' admonition of separating the realm of faith and the realm of rulers was an imperfect arrangement, to be sure. But this distinction served as an important check on the arbitrary rule of kings by introducing the idea that even rulers were answerable to a higher law. This was in marked contrast with Chinese emperors and Islamic sultans. While Christians had to render unto Caesars, Muhammad played the role of both Caesar and Jesus. And the political system he left behind recognized no space between secular and religious authority. Without that space, institutional pluralism and the division of meaning are impossible. Also, some insist that Christianity, I would argue borrowing from Judaism, invented or introduced the idea of individual rights. Larry Siedentop, in his Inventing the Individual, The Origins of Western Liberalism, argues that by the 15th century, the internal logic of Christianity's emphasis on the individual conscience had made the Enlightenment all but inevitable. Again, maybe. Then again, maybe not. It is quite simply impossible to know. There were certainly countless Christian regimes and movements that were hostile to innovation, individual liberty, and pluralism. Would the miracle have happened if they had won their battles? But again, my aim here is not actually to discredit or rebut any of the serious arguments for why the miracle happened, because I think many have merit. But all of the material factors are meaningless absent the broader context of culture. Biologists can grow just about anything in a lab, but they can't grow anything without the right medium. At the end of the day, it is impossible to authoritatively answer the question of why beyond simply documenting that it happened. Why do certain ideas take hold and others do not? Why did the ideas of a Jewish carpenter in a backwater province of the Roman Empire capture the minds of millions and ultimately conquer the empire itself? The devout Christian can argue because they were true. But as a sociological question, the only answer is that they just did. The more important question is, will it last? McCloskey is a great optimist about the miracle's prospects. I hope that optimism is warranted, but it seems to me axiomatic that an explanation of capitalism's birth, grounded entirely in the power of ideas and words, opens itself to a depressing rejoinder. What words and ideas can create, words and ideas can destroy. Whatever we can think ourselves into, we can unthink our way out of. And here, we must consider what I believe is the most persuasive theory of why capitalism might be fated to vanish, either from the earth or at least from America and the West. To do so, we must first look at the most influential and famous prophecy of capitalism's demise, made by Karl Marx. According to Marx, the working classes, the proletariat, were the sole source of all economic value. The real value of any good or service is derived not from the price it fetches in the market, but from the amount of time and effort put into it by the laborer. Hence, under Marx's labor theory of value, when a factory owner sells that product at a profit, that profit is surplus value, and by its nature exploitative and unjust. Indeed, for Marx, the economic ruling classes were akin to vampires, and his writing is full of blood-sucking imagery, which at the time was often a thinly veiled and occasionally explicit anti-Semitic reference to greedy Jewish moneylenders. In Marx's futuristic fairy tale, the workers of the world would one day in the near future recognize that they were merely wage slaves and, having attained class consciousness, would overthrow their masters, seize the means of production, and live in a new utopian world where they would live very much like modern noble savages, working as much or as little as they wanted in a state of blissful harmony. There are three things that need to be said about Marx's romantic vision. First, it truly was romantic, grounded in profound alienation and paranoia about the society he lived in. Second, for all of its pseudoscientific jargon, Marxism was not a modern, forward-thinking project. Rather, it was a modern-sounding rehabilitation of ancient ideas and sentiments. For the Christian, the meek would inherit the earth. For the Marxist, the workers would. And third, Marx's vision was entirely wrong. The idea that the inventor or the entrepreneur creates no value by bringing an idea into the world is ridiculous. According to Marx's economic analysis, the inventor of a better mousetrap doesn't create any value. Only the workers who put it together do. But it was Marx's political or sociological analysis that really missed the mark. To understand why, we need to look to Joseph Schumpeter, one of the great economists of the 20th century. In Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, 1942, Schumpeter argued that capitalism was ultimately doomed, but not remotely for the reasons Marx had predicted. Schumpeter turned Karl Marx on his head, writes biographer Thomas K. McCraw. Hateful gangs of parasitic capitalists become, in Schumpeter's hands, innovative and beneficent entrepreneurs. Schumpeter saw and explained, earlier than almost anyone, that the power of capitalism stemmed in large part from the liberation of and tolerance for entrepreneurs. The entrepreneur is the engine of innovation, and innovation is what drives economic growth by finding new opportunities for wealth, where mere investors and managers so only the way we've always done things. One of Schumpeter's key insights, and quite radical at the time, was to look at economic actors as entities over time, and economics generally as an evolutionary process. The market is constantly changing, and companies that are monopolies one minute fall prey to innovative firms that render them obsolete the next minute. The driver of that process was what Schumpeter famously called creative destruction. Schumpeter applied the same insight to capitalism itself and concluded that capitalism itself would fall prey to a kind of social analog to creative destruction. His analysis is rich and complicated, but I will highlight the three essential components as they relate to my argument. First, capitalism is relentlessly and unsentimentally rational and efficient. The free market tends to wipe away tradition and ritual in the name of profit. This is a wonderful thing when the traditions and rituals it is corroding are based in bigotry and oppression. But like water seeking its own level, the capitalist tide doesn't stop at clearing away bad forms of tradition, custom, and sentiment. It carves a path through the social landscape, heedless of the social value certain institutions and customs provide. Or, as Schumpeter puts it, capitalism creates a critical frame of mind which, after having destroyed the moral authority of so many other institutions, in the end turns against its own. The bourgeois finds, to his amazement, that the rationalist attitude does not stop at the credentials of kings and popes, but goes on to attack private property and the whole scheme of bourgeois values. Anyone who has bemoaned the demise of a beloved bookstore or bakery because it was more profitable to build a bank branch understands the point. To the mind of the pure profit maximizer, a public park is a waste of space compared to a lucrative parking lot. The rationalist, who only seeks perfect economic efficiency, sees no reason not to use a church as a stable. Schumpeter called the moral and sentimental attachments that tell us there are more important things than simple efficiency and profit maximization extra-rational or extra-capitalist commitments. The extra here means outside or above or apart from. The problem is that, as we've seen, the free market needs extra-rational customs and traditions to survive. The capitalist order, Schumpeter explains, not only rests on props made of extra-capitalist material, but also derives its energy from extra-capitalist patterns of behavior, which at the same time it is bound to destroy. As we've seen, capitalism emerged from a specific culture, and it depends on the habits of the heart that made it possible. Thrift, delayed gratification, and honesty, not to mention the sovereignty of the individual, aren't simply products of mere reason. They are also extra-rational commitments derived in the Western context from Christianity, custom, history, family, patriotism, language, and all of the other ingredients that make up culture and faith. No institution or practice or belief stands or falls with the theory that is at any time offered in its support, Schumpeter writes. Democracy is no exception. Schumpeter is making the same point I made earlier about the Constitution. What sustains the constitutional order is our faith in it, not merely the arguments for it. Think of it this way. No one is loyal to their family based solely on some theory of family loyalty. The theory is downstream of the more important and powerful emotional and instinctual commitments. The same dynamic applies to the political and religious systems we live under. The second component of Schumpeter's theory is that capitalism's relentless assault on tradition and custom creates a market opportunity for intellectuals, lawyers, writers, artists, bureaucrats, and other professionals who work with ideas to undermine and ridicule the existing system. They do so for a host of reasons. Some have a largely frivolous, even funny desire to shock the bourgeoisie. Others, such as Marx, have a passionate and radical anger at the real or perceived injustices of modern society. But there is another, more cynical explanation for why the peddlers of words, symbols, and ideas declare war on the existing system. They have a class interest in doing so. As Joel Mokyr puts it in The Gifts of Athena, Historical Origins of the Knowledge Economy, sooner or later in any society, the progress of technology will grind to a halt because the forces that used to support innovation become vested interests. He adds, in a purely dialectical fashion, technological progress creates the very forces that eventually destroy it. But the reason groups become vested interests isn't solely economic. When I use the term class interest, I do not mean the simple pursuit of economic gain, as the Marxist does, or as the public choice economist does. Man lives by more than bread or profit alone. Intellectuals surely have a financial motive in arguing for a system in which intellectuals would run things. But they also have a psychological one. That desire is often the more important one. Marx wanted to be the high priest of a new world order, but he didn't necessarily want to be rich. We are wired to want to have higher status than others. We are also wired to resent those who we believe have undeservedly higher status than we do. Intellectuals and artistic elites have heaped scorn on other elites, the wealthy, the military, the bourgeois, the church, for centuries. Schumpeter's analysis was deeply influenced by Friedrich Nietzsche's concept of ressentiment, or resentment, laid out